This is Cascadia Public Radio.
Good morning, and thank you for tuning in to A Deeper Look, the program that confronts key social and political challenges facing the world today. I'm Linda Olson Osterlund, and I want to give a special thanks to all of you out there who contributed during our fall membership drive. Thanks so much. That makes such a difference. Today, we're focusing on the CIA, torture, and the role of health professionals. At the end of August, the 2004 CIA The 2004 CIA Inspector General's report was finally released as a result of the ACLU's lawsuit. That was a five-year-long lawsuit. Though heavily redacted, the report was very revealing. My guest today is Dr. Scott Allen. He's the medical advisor to Physicians for Human Rights, or PHR, a founder and co-director of the Center for Prisoner Health and Human Rights at Brown University, and the co-author of PHR's report, Aiding Torture, Health Professionals, Ethics, and Human Rights Violations Revealed in the May 2004 CIA Inspector General's Report. Welcome to KABU, Dr. Allen, and thanks so much for joining me.
Well, thank you, Linda. It's a pleasure to be with you.
Oh, I'm so glad you could. Now, if you could, tell us what new we learned from the Inspector General's report. What was confirmed from the past, and what new revelations came out?
Well, from the broadest perspective, the most important thing confirmed was additional details about a program of psychological torture that was used by the CIA and authorized by the U.S. government. So this was probably the most clear and explicit account of that program to date. And as you implied, it does build on information that had been revealed earlier from other government sources and other reports. But this is probably the clearest picture. The second thing you've already tipped your hat to, and that is it's certainly the clearest account of the very disturbing role that was played by healthcare professionals in designing and implementing, monitoring, and justifying the program.
Which is very important. This has been suspected. It's been known to some degree, but not revealed near in as much detail or obvious as it is in this. But let's go ahead and start with some of these new techniques that were revealed in this report. We all know about the 10 techniques. We may not all remember them all. We may actually want to forget many of them, including the waterboarding and stress positions and many other kinds of techniques that are supposedly now outlawed. But there were new ones, ones we hadn't officially heard of before.
That's correct. And you are correct that previous accounts had revealed things like the stress positions, temperature manipulation, waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and isolation, sexual humiliation, and prolonged isolation, things of that nature. This report revealed some techniques that we had not seen reported before, and they included things like forced shaving, which had cultural implications and issues of autonomy and personal space, prolonged hooding, not brief hooding as you might see for transport, but prolonged hooding for sensory deprivation. A very disturbing one called diapering, where people who have normal control of their bowel and bladder are forced to wear a diaper for a very prolonged period of time until it would become necessary to use it, which is both physically uncomfortable and often, by accounts we have from the Red Cross, left in the soiled diaper for an extended period of time. Walling, which is a blunt trauma technique where the detainees' head is slammed against a flexible wall. And finally, a variation on stress positions, confinement in a small box for extended periods.
And these were all techniques that were approved by the 2002 executive order that Bush issued. Is that accurate?
Yes, that's correct, because in fact the report did reveal some other techniques that were not approved, things like mock executions and threats to family members and so forth that were not on the list of approved techniques that were also found to be used in the field by the CIA Inspector General.
Now, Dr. Allen, you were the co-author of an earlier PHR report that examined 11 former detainees gave them physical and psychological examinations and talked with them about their former abuse and were able to establish from their current state that, in fact, their physical and mental status showed that those abuses were likely exactly what caused their long-term injuries. Can you talk a little bit about, I know you guys haven't had the chance to go fully into it with these new techniques, but can you just let our audience have a sense of what a person enduring some of these techniques might suffer from for probably the rest of their lives?
Sure. Well, first of all, I would like to give a little background on how we know what we know. You referred to a series of formalized and standardized exams we undertook with 11 former detainees. That report, Broken Laws, Broken Lives, is available on the Internet on our website. And in that case, we examined 11 former detainees from Abu Ghraib and Guantanamo and other places of U.S. detention. And they underwent formalized exams by torture treatment experts using a standardized exam that is endorsed by the United Nations for victims of torture. And in those exams, we found evidence of torture and evidence of consequences of torture, including things like post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, anxiety, and so forth. But in addition to those 11 anecdotal reports, there is actually very rich literature on the effects of these techniques. These techniques are new in terms of being authorized for use by the CIA. We should hasten to add that they've now been taken off the table, but they were authorized at the time that this report dealt with between 2002 and 2004. But the techniques themselves are actually old Cold War techniques. These techniques were used on a number of people, but including U.S. pilots who were downed and taken prisoner in places like North Korea and China and so forth. So these techniques have been around for a while, and there's a literature of torture survivors who have been exposed to these techniques that tell us that a significant number and likely a majority go on to develop these long-term psychological consequences like post-traumatic stress disorder.
And post-traumatic stress disorder, you know, we're so used to that phrase now, and we see PTSD, and I think it's important for people to realize how debilitating it can be, and it's not necessarily like the dramatic flashbacks we used to see when they talk about Vietnam veterans. It can be just everyday a heightened level of fearfulness, or a certain event happens and the fear escalates out of control. It can be just a strongly elevated startle effect. Anybody makes a certain noise around you and you find yourself jumping and twitching. And every time one of those reactions happens, there's a whole cascade of internal chemical reactions that are also difficult for the body to cope with. Isn't that accurate?
Well, that's exactly correct. Everything you described is true. And there's also interesting data emerging now that actually has been emerging for a number of years now, that there are actual changes that go on even at the brain level. Remember, the one thing that is in common with a high-stress event is a hormonal response from adrenaline to cortisol to other hormones that get released. And these hormones at real high levels can have traumatic effects on brain tissue, in addition to other parts of the body. So that there actually is a physiology that underlies this disorder. And you're absolutely correct. It can be debilitating at a number of different levels. It can be intrusive on a daily level. The other thing I like to point out to people, there's a rich literature from, in particular, from our own Veterans Affairs Department following vets over the years, that shows that it may not even manifest until decades after the original insult. In other words, there are any number of combat veterans who would have said for 30, 40 years, well, yeah, it was rough over there, but I'm doing fine, and in their 60s or 70s start to experience the hyperarousal, the flashbacks, the nightmares, and all the things that can be associated, depression, anxiety, and so forth with this disorder. And the last thing I'd like to mention, and people, your listeners might have caught this as it was reported in the paper just this last week, there is a recent VA study showing a significantly higher death rate in surgery in veterans who carry a diagnosis of PTSD, higher death rate than their...
Very interesting. I didn't catch that. That's very interesting. It makes sense to me because I think the body is so damaged by ongoing PTSD that you're compromised.
Exactly. I mean, And I mentioned the hormonal responses in PTSD. This sort of hyperarousal and exaggerated stress response does often continue. So you can end up with a really prolonged expression of stress hormones, and that can lead to damage over time.
Now, we know that the 10 already earlier identified techniques have been officially banned by Obama. My reading of his executive order rescinding the earlier executive orders would say that these new techniques were also part of what was banned, these newly revealed techniques, I guess we should say. I am, however, skeptical the United States has a long history of involvement in torture, including what used to be called the School of Americas, where we trained people in, quote, aggressive interrogation. However, I do think it's important that Obama officially banned them. Let's get into the role of professionals. Now, I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Allen of Physicians for Human Rights. Let's talk about what this report revealed about health professionals. I think this is a very critical and key issue for our society to deal with.
Well, as I said at the opening, the health professional role that we always suspected, I should point out to your listeners that I worked full-time for 7 years as a full-time prison physician in the state of Rhode Island, both as a primary care physician and later the medical director for the state program. So when these early reports of torture and abuse started coming out in the press, a lot of us said, boy, where were the doctors? Because you have to have doctors to run a detainee operation, and wouldn't they have noticed evidence of torture, and did they intervene to stop? So that was sort of the framework that a lot of us got initially interested in looking at this. We're quite disturbed to find, come to the end of it, that the health professionals had such a fundamental role in designing and implementing and monitoring this program, and really ultimately helped provide the legal justification for the program, and I can elaborate on that. But the program was designed, in fact, by psychologists who had experience as trainers in working with a program that's important here, a survival training program for uniformed servicemen who are at high risk of being captured. This is a program that's been around for years. It's called SEER or SERE for Survival Evasion Resistance and Escape.
And you're talking about James Mitchell and Bruce Jessam of Mitchell, Jessam and Associates up in Spokane, Washington.
Correct. Right. These were at the time retired psychologists, retired from their work with the SEER program. And again, just briefly, that program was a resistance training program for people like pilots or special forces who are at high risk of being captured. And they would put them through mock torture. When I say mock torture, from what we understand of that program, it was very realistic mock torture. It was highly stressful. And in fact, there happens to be a scientific literature from that training program, which is where we get a lot of our information about how high cortisol levels go using these techniques. Those two psychologists were actually approached and asked in the retired state and now as private contractors to help devise this interrogation program. And what they did is the initial draft of these specific techniques that were drawn from this torture survival program. So, I mean, that background is important to point out that we started with something that we considered was torture when it was being done by enemies of the United States or people who held our servicemen captive. We had no question that it was torture then. We developed a training resistance program for it, and then when we reverse engineered it back to our own interrogation, obviously you end up with torture.
And these two gentlemen, by the way, are still operating up in the Spokane area. They have 125 employees in their firm, and I believe that they're still conducting SERE training. Whether they're involved in a program involving interrogation of detainees still, we don't know.
Yeah, we don't know, but the more important issue you get to is the issue of accountability, which we can talk about. Perhaps, though, let me continue, if I may,
yes,
with the other roles that health professionals played. So when the program was drafted by Mitchell and Jessen and presumably some others, the next thing it had to be vetted by scientific advisors to say whether this was a legitimate program to go forward. So that's the next participation of health professionals and scientists who were consulted by the government. And this was an interesting period of what I would call bootstrapping, where this was appears to have been a conversation going back and forth between lawyers from the Office of Legal Counsel, your listeners might remember those memos were released earlier this year in providing the legal rationalization for a torture program. And basically, they jumped in the pool together in the following way. The lawyers crafted a new definition for torture that really raised the bar so high that a lot of things that were traditionally viewed as torture would probably not meet their new definition. And then they turned to the doctors and scientists and said, if this is the definition of torture, do these techniques rise to that level? And to give your listeners a reference, remember, these are the memos where they pinned the definition of torture to harm equivalent to organ failure or death.
This is you and Bybee, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
That's correct.
The two attorneys.
So that's the next role health professionals and scientists play, that they, you know, help provide the legal justification. That one's particularly disturbing for me because I think it was a bad faith use of science. And more importantly, this is where health professionals should have stepped in and stopped this program. They have access to knowledge about how harmful these effects are. There's a rich literature, as I've suggested. And it was their professional responsibility to say, you know, you've approached us as scientific and professional advisors. We're here to tell you, you can't go down this path. It's highly inappropriate. But they evidently didn't. The next thing we know from the CIA Inspector General's report is that health professionals were instructed and, in fact, required to monitor detainees undergoing these interrogation techniques. And in fact, again, that was also, back to the bootstrapping, was used to justify the supposed legality of these techniques. And if you go back and look at those OLC memos, they say, technique after technique, well, a doctor will be present, therefore it's safe. And then again, that emphasizes how inappropriate, how a doctor's presence became permissive.
Well, and I recall how they would actually say, well, the doctors are in there to make sure that nothing goes too far.
That's correct.
Is that true?
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. Doctors in a position to calibrate harm, which is an inappropriate activity and violates all well-established professional ethics.
Well, and the first now, so you're getting towards the edge of human experimentation. Do you want to just go ahead and talk about that?
Well, there was one area in this Inspector General's report. There was an important appendix, again, heavily redacted. And by the way, probably since 9/11, a lot of people know what redacted means. But if they don't, it's as if someone highlighted a document, all the good parts, instead of with a nice bright yellow transparent highlighter like we all used in high school, with a black opaque magic markers, so you can't see anything. So there's large sections of this document that are blocked out, we can't read. But from what we can read in this Appendix F, this is a memoranda of instructions for the health professionals asked to monitor these techniques. And it's actually very chilling reading. Again, this document, you know, if you Google it, the CIA Inspector General's report of 7 May 2004, you can download this as a PDF. And even though it's a little bit long, you can skim through the redacted pages because they're blacked out. But Appendix F is about the instructions for the medical doctors. And it's actually quite chilling. It goes technique by technique and again, gets into this fine calibration of harm. Remember, there's nothing therapeutic about this. This is all intended to cause significant psychological stress and pain. And so just the very fact that they have instructions for doctors on how to fine-tune this is deeply disturbing.
With the purpose of breaking the person down.
Absolutely. Exactly correct. That's the aim of these techniques, is to create a state of so-called learned helplessness and disrupt the personality. But the part that you're referring to is there is a very disturbing section in the protocol for waterboarding that admits as much as they don't have a lot of experience using waterboarding to know how to do it completely safely. So they ask the doctors to take very detailed notes on how much water was used, how long did any of it get into the airway, and so forth, so that they could be reviewed and evaluated to perhaps modify the protocol. So, you know, you have a methodology, and you're asking health professionals to collect data that will be analyzed to modify the methodology. That is getting towards experimentation, if it isn't experimentation. But I have to be careful and say we're careful to say it that way, because I think it falls short of what we consider full experimental protocol, but it's provocative. And we know that we only have some of the information related to these programs.
Well, yes, and that's one of my concerns, is that there's such a the government and the CIA have been working so hard to keep this information secret, and only little bits surface again and again. I know that I looked up the Nuremberg Code, which dealt with human experimentation on death camp people who were experimented on by the Nazis, and it occurred to me that in most of the Nazi experimentation, there was at least ostensibly some value to a larger society, like they did hypothermia experiments that were horrendous and resulted in many deaths, freezing people in freezing water to get data on how well people did with hypothermia, supposedly to help if their pilots, German pilots, went in the water. But the experimentation that appears to be happening, and I'll say appears, but I'm not quite as cautious as you. I'm not a doctor or professional, and I don't quite have to be, I would say, looks like what they were trying to do was refine the torture techniques. And also, all of the information I've gotten about the various forms of sensory deprivation, overloading with sound, using teams they call IRF in Guantanamo, would make me think that that they are keeping notes on every single detainee, at the very least keeping records on what types of these kinds of techniques they're utilizing and how the prisoner responds. Now, maybe that's not experimentation, but gee, it sure gets close to that line, especially if it's then used to do a better job of destabilizing that prisoner. The other thing
I guess what I'm just going to say to follow on that is, without even necessarily using the phrase experimentation, one thing's clear from reviewing the publicly available information is that they were winging it. There was no experience, a recent experience in the U.S. government with these techniques as a way of getting actionable intelligence. And in fact, as an aside, it appears to have a very poor record of doing that. As a scientist, it's of interest to me that those effects that I described on the brain from high stress hormone levels actually impair memory and are more likely to lead to psychological states such as dissociation, which is where you sort of step outside your body and become very removed from the situation. And all of these things would not necessarily help get accurate, honest information if you're attempting if that's your ostensible mission. So, in fact, it's damaging, potentially counterproductive. I should add that if it were productive, we would still object to it on ethical grounds.
Absolutely. One of my things, I've been wondering about this. The reports that I've read said that a doctor and a psychologist had to be present for every interrogation. Do we know who these doctors are? And also, I know from reading that even those who commit torture can experience post-traumatic stress disorder from what they did, not what was done to them. People aren't, it's not, you know, people vomit when they see people cut open or, you know, in horrible circumstances. It's not natural to us to cause great harm to others over a prolonged period. So do we know anything about who these psychologists and doctors are? And do you think that we ever will?
At this point, we don't. And it's a good, we are talking about a CIA program, so it's very likely that we never will have specific names. Of course, the names that you referred to of Mitchell and Jessen did get leaked to the press at some point, so they are now names that have been reported in a number of venues. But beyond that, there are not specific names. And certainly if they were in this Inspector General's report, they're definitely redacted. So we don't have the specific names of people involved. My emerging impression, I want to be very careful to say it's just that, is that it was a relatively small group of professionals, which on the one hand might reassure some people that it was only a small number, but the danger in a violation of professional ethic is it only takes a small number of people to do great harm to the profession as a whole. Probably something we should touch upon, in that as a doctor who's worked in prison settings, one of my greatest concerns is the primary function of doctors and other health professionals working for the government, whether they're civilian or in the uniform military services, is to take care of injured and wounded and sick servicemen and women, but also prisoners of war. to take care of prisoners of war, and I'm using that term in its original term, which includes everyone, not the Bush narrow definition, but prisoners or detainees, whichever you call them, it's a very difficult job. It requires establishing a level of trust from between the doctor and the patient, just like what happened in the civilian sector, except obviously it's very difficult to establish that trust. This type of program greatly undermines the ability of doctors to establish a therapeutic relationship with prisoners or detainees, because now a prisoner or detainee legitimately questions the motives of the doctor and wonders if they're really acting in their interest. Most doctors answer to a first do no harm ethic. It's one of the most fundamental medical ethics. But a patient who comes into U.S. custody might well ask, does my doctor follow that ethic? Because there's a good record that doctors working for the U.S. government were instructed not to follow that, and they complied.
Well,
so it's
and
very
I
damaging to doctors in general. I do want to mention, follow up briefly on your very provocative question about how damaging is torture to the torturer. It can be as damaging as it is to the victim. And there's actually some good essays that have appeared in print by former interrogators describing their own symptoms of nightmares and insomnia and anxiety and so forth related to the turmoil that they still feel over their role in torturing detainees.
Though I wish nobody harm, really, there's a part of me that says, well, and you got what you gave. However, I actually don't want anyone suffering from those kind of symptoms. A jail would be a better solution for people who commit this kind of crime. And I do know that one of your reports that I read went very deeply into the legal ramifications, whether these techniques did still meet a legal definition of torture, and was very well annotated, by the way. And I will link to your reports on my website. To remind my audience, I'm speaking with Dr. Scott Allen, a physician for human rights. I will link to those reports, but it did a really good job, I felt, of laying the historical and current basis for how each one of these techniques still violates, even after they've tried to water down internally to the United States what counts as torture. These techniques would still result, they still rise to that level. There's no question they rise to the level of torture or cruel and inhumane treatment. Some of these techniques, I fear, are continuing to be used by the Army and the military elsewhere, including sensory deprivation and solitary confinement and bombardment. And I believe in Guantanamo they're still using unpredictable use of teams called ERFs that can run in and grab a detainee very violently, and that detainees have expressed fear of even leaving their cells because of that. And fear of, they're afraid to say anything because it can be used as an excuse for punishment. So I fear we're not done with this. I do think it's really important, the work that Physicians for Human Rights are doing, to highlight that this is not the role of health professionals. This is not what they're intended to do. Is there any accountability through professional societies or any way else with regard to this kind of treatment?
Well, that's a real challenge to the profession. So far, organized medicine, groups like the AMA and the American Psychiatric Association, psychological associations, have said that unless someone's a member and stands accused, they have no ability to do anything, because all they really can do is remove someone from membership of their organization. State licensure boards are another potential venue, but so far they have said they lack jurisdiction. These alleged abuses of professional role were alleged to have occurred outside the United States and under the jurisdiction of the U.S. military. So they say it's the U.S. military's call whether this is misconduct, and if they say it wasn't, or it's the CIA's judgment about whether it was misconduct, and if they say it wasn't, then they have no jurisdiction.
Well, thank you so much, Dr. Allen. I wish that we had longer. We do not. I've been speaking with Dr. Scott Allen of Physicians for Human Rights. An audio from today's show will be available after today and up on our website at kboo.fm, and I will link to the Physicians for Human Rights website. The reports on there are illuminating and very well documented. If you want to study about the role of trauma and PTSD, you could just read the footnotes, I have to say. So thank you so much for joining us today, Dr. Allen. Hopefully we will be able to push forward in getting accountability for this type of behavior.
Well, thank you, Linda.
Bye-bye. And please stay tuned in next week for, I mean, tune in 2 weeks for my show, when my guest will be Jeff Charlotte, who will talk about the Christian crusade to take over the U.S. military. And now we'll be going to Air Cascadia.
Thanks very much to everyone who donated during our fall membership drive. However, we ended short of our financial goal by roughly $30,000, or nearly 25%. To help close this significant budget gap, please make an online contribution right now at kboo.fm, especially if you didn't do so during our drive. And as always, thanks for helping keep KBOO on the air.
Good morning, Cascadia. You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. Today is Thursday, October 22nd, 2009, and this is Air Cascadia. Long on content, short on time. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Liam Delta.
We all know that PGE's coal-fired Boardman power plant has what it's done to the air. But do you ever wonder where all that coal actually comes from?
Clatsop County commissioners are elected, but Coos Bay Port Commissioners are appointed by the governor. Big difference.
And Big Pharma gets lobbied up in the name of pill profits. Portland area weather today. Bit of fog out there this morning. Cloudy later in the day with temperatures in the mid-60s tonight. Cloudy with a low around 51. Tomorrow, rain mainly after 11 a.m. and highs around 59. First, we go to regional news from around Cascadia. Yesterday, Oregonians rallied in Pioneer Square to speak out and hear others speak out against the West's coal-fired power plants. Here in Oregon, the dirty secret is that 40% of our power is coal-generated. But where does all that coal come from? My guest today knows exactly where it comes from and what coal mining has done to the land and the people. Brad Moorman with the Wyoming Sierra Club joins us today by cell phone as he's on his way to Seattle with Otto Braided Hair, Cheyenne tribal leader, and Wyoming rancher R.J. Turner, two of the speakers at yesterday's event. Good morning, Brad.
Good morning. How are you?
Well, thanks. How is it going? Talk a little bit first about Sierra Club trip around the West, talking about these issues.
Well, basically what we're doing right now, we spent yesterday in Portland and we're heading to Seattle today to kind of educate people out here about where their power's coming from. I've always heard, and we've always heard, and people always tout the Northwest and Portland, Seattle as being very green cities, and they are, and that they should be commended for that. But part of this story that's not told is when you're burning coal out here, which both cities are, that coal is coming from the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana. And the area we call home is being sacrificed completely for energy usage around the country.
Apparently, the rancher, L.J. Turner, 6,000 acres of his land has been affected. How has it been affected?
Well, what LJ has been impacted by, for really almost 40 years now, is the coal companies literally eating up grazing land that he used to graze his cattle on there. They're eating up coal mining. And that continues to this day. There's a major coal expansion for several mines that could essentially wipe out land he's been ranching and grazing his cattle on for generations. His family's been there since 1918. And these coal industries come in and basically, aided by the federal government, the BLM and the Forest Service, just say that the better use of this land is for coal mining.
Sure.
And people fully need to realize that when they turn on their light switches, when they're running their electronics, something is happening at the other end to devastate the Powder River Basin. And we need to find new ways to generate power and do things, or this devastation is going to continue.
So these are the things that we don't see when we look down the Columbia River Gorge and we see that brown haze coming from the Boardman plant, that haze really stretches all the way back to Wyoming, to the Powder River Basin, and to lives and land that we're not in contact with. Thank you so much for that. My guest has been Brad Moorman with the Wyoming Sierra Club.
Yesterday in New York, an advisory committee to the federal government voted unanimously to further ease compensation requirements for Hanford workers who may have developed cancers due to radiation exposure. The compensation program offers automatic $150,000 payments to potentially hundreds more Hanford workers or their survivors. Kathleen Sebelius, Secretary of Health and Human Services, is expected to recommend the eased rules to Congress. The term for this is special exposure cohort. Sounds so much nicer than death by radiation compensation.
Doesn't it, though? Yeah, you can even greenwash death. Turns out even hardcore Republicans, such as Washington State's Doc Hastings, are wondering what we're going to do with America's burgeoning, glow-in-the-dark pile of radioactive waste. Hastings is asking President Obama how the nation plans to store or dispose of radioactive waste from the Hanford Nuclear Reservation and the Energy Northwest Nuclear Power Plant. Over the past 25 years, the nation has spent $10 billion to $12 billion just to study Yucca Mountain as a site for a national repository. But last February, Obama nixed the plan. Instead, he said he would launch a Blue Ribbon Committee to lead federal efforts to look for disposal solutions based on objective scientific analysis. There goes another $10 to $12 billion. Mm.
Rock Ridge Farms and Mayfield Farms, just outside Portland, have received certification for humane farming systems. Both supply beef and dairy to Pacific Natural Foods, which is owned by the same family that owns the farms. Pacific Natural Foods will be one of the first with widely distributed products certified by the Animal Welfare Approved, a nonprofit third-party organization that audits family farms for high welfare standards. The standards include raising animals outdoors, prohibiting genetically engineered animals, and banning the non-therapeutic use of antibiotics.
St. Helens is slated to be the site of the Northwest's first facility for recycling plastic, water, and pop bottles. The $10 million complex was made possible by state legislation, which set a 5-cent deposit on bottled water containers that took effect last January. That's the reason why the project is going ahead now. It wasn't possible before the new law to collect enough recyclable bottles to supply a recycling facility in Oregon. At least the St. Helens plant will eventually employ 50 people, and maybe one day we will take environmental stewardship seriously, stop logging, slow the growth, and protect the watershed. But by that time, the world will be well past peak oil, and there will be no plastic to sell water or anything else in. It's funny how we deal really well with small problems like meat or plastic water bottles, but climate change or nuclear waste, these are things that we really don't like to look at unless there's $10 or $12 billion tied up in it.
Right. Steve Forrester writes in the Daily Astorian, quote, "The political sign in front of the Astoria Warrant and Chamber of Commerce building that urges voters to support the county begs a couple questions. Support the county in this case really is about saving the political careers of County Commissioners Jeff Hazen and Ann Samuelson. Which part of rescuing Hazen and Samuelson is good for local business? If this attempted recall is about LNG, is the Astoria Warrant and Chamber of Commerce saying that LNG terminals on the lower Columbia River are good for the chamber's membership? Good questions.
It is about LNG. That's the answer. Yeah. That's what it's about. Exactly. Well, the people of Astoria are lucky that they can elect different port commissioners. The county commissioners. In Coos Bay, the port commissioners, though, are appointed by the governor. Activists have filed letter after letter and are completely ignored because no one is willing to go up against agencies in the state or the governor. First off, they'd have to get their own attorneys. They'd have to file charges in order to change the way the Port of Coos Bay does business. Nobody knows this better than my guest this morning, Jody McCaffrey. Good morning, Jody. Thanks for joining us here on Air Cascadia again today.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's a lot of news. There's a meeting today,
yes.
I understand. Oregon International Port of Coos Bay Special Port Commission meeting. Wow, sounds important. What's going on?
Well, they'll be, today they're going to be working on this land use option agreement that they have with Weyerhaeuser and Jordan Cove Energy Project. As if you look at the agenda, they have that on the agenda, plus this advocacy of the Oregon Resources Project, which is the chromite mining. There's no public comment. It's just kind of like they're going to come in, have an executive session, come out and rubber stamp whatever they've decided, and then we get to live with the result.
The chromite mining is something that hasn't really been on the radar, and activists haven't become involved in that, but again, it impacts the environment.
Yes, I have not gotten heavily involved in that, although I know it's an issue because it's quite a large area that they're wanting to mine down here, and it's going to impact our watershed areas. That there you go, and more impacts to the fishing and stuff. You know, I'm so heavily busy dealing with the issue with Jordan Cove, and, you know, this impacts, I don't, all of the state of Oregon, because part of this agreement that they're working out with Weyerhaeuser involves money, funds from the state of Oregon and also Umpqua Bank, that, of course, us port taxpayers will have to be responsible for paying back if this doesn't all work. But it's very frustrating when the port is appointed and not elected. We cannot have any recourse if things are not done, you know, with proper public procedures.
And why would taxpayers have to pay this money back if things don't go as planned?
Well, because they're, part of this land deal involves a Weyerhaeuser property. The property the property 3 years ago when this land deal was first put together was assessed at $5 million. And the port is, this option agreement has the port paying $25 million for property that was assessed at $5 million. So we're paying five times the assessed value for this property. And $15 million of that came from the state of Oregon, the Economic Development Department's a grant from them. So when we've raised, well, I've raised issues with this, and it's very frustrating because who didn't pay attention? Is this really worth, is this property really worth $25 million? Well, they did do appraisals after the land deal was already signed and on the dotted line. And the appraisals actually used the option agreement to justify the price of the land. It wasn't based on what the land is actually worth. So, I don't know. I have written letters asking that there be somebody investigate this, and it just never gets anywhere. So it's very frustrating.
It seems to me when there's such a huge discrepancy, just give us those numbers again. Originally it's assessed at $5 million, but now that figure is, tell us again.
And the property at the time, the original, in 2006, in May of 2006, these option agreements were hammered out. And the property at that time was assessed at $5 million. And they are paying, are their option was, and this is all contingent on the liquefied natural gas being cited. That's why it hasn't actually gone through. They keep extending these options. Well, they've extended them now 3 years, and so the appraisals they did actually are 3 years old, so they need to be redone. But if you look at the appraisals, the property was assessed at $5 million, and they were saying the property, the port is agreeing to pay Weyerhaeuser $25 million for this property.
That's an incredible discrepancy, and I understand, too, that the necessary permits and so forth, let alone a draft environmental impact statement, have yet to emerge out of all of this.
Well, they actually, in 1999, Nucor, I don't know if you remember, Nucor mm-hmm. still was looking at some of this same property, and they actually backed out because Weyerhaeuser wanted them to take all the environmental assessments of the property responsibility of it, even past contamination, and the Nucor wouldn't do it. Well, the port, of course, just signed and said, yeah, fine. That, and I don't know, as far as I can tell by checking, they have not done all the proper environmental assessments of the property. So they're just actually putting taxpayers at an extreme liability if there's a bunch of contamination that takes a lot of money to clean up.
Not only that, but, of course, just simply the purchase price is $25 million is supposedly going to be paid back with revenue and taxes from an LNG project that is yet to be approved. That's almost like blackmail.
Yeah.
But Jody, that's exactly. That's all we have time for today. But thank you so much for joining us. And my guest has been Jody McCaffrey, Coos Bay's leading anti-LNG activist. Again, thank you so much for being back with us today, Jody.
Thank you for having me.
A bizarre U.S. law triggers the deportation of surviving immigrant spouses of American citizens who die before they've been married 2 years. The move is all part of the Obama administration's rethinking some of the more arcane corners of a Homeland Security bill. The new law would allow the widows to submit petitions seeking residency even when the spouse dies before 2 years of marriage. No one could possibly show that the old law has in any way made America safer, but it did make personal tragedies worse by triggering the automatic deportations.
And just very briefly in closing, does the name Billy Towson ring a bell? It should. Towson is the former chairman of the House Energy and Commerce Committee. He was instrumental in ensuring the odious Medicare Part D's passage. Towson reeked of corruption and found his place as a high-paid lobbyist for, what else? The pharmaceutical companies. Now, he's at the center of the Republicans' fight to protect big pharma profits at any cost to the public. For example, the 12-year patent sunset is but one example of the windfall in store for drug makers.
This has been Air Cascadia for Thursday, October 22, 2009. Engineering is Emily Young. Kathleen Stevenson is the KBOO AM News and Public Affairs Director. Chris Andre is the producer. I'm Liam Delta.
You're listening to All Natural, Free Range, Non-Syndicated KBOO Radio. 90.7 FM in Portland, KBOO.FM on the web. Your support and your support only keeps us subverting the dominant paradigm. Thank you so much, members. And again, welcome new members. And don't forget, it's always membership time at KBOO.
Coming up next, Flashpoints, part 3 of the Anatomy of a Financial Coup d'etat.